This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
For long-time listeners to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture, you may have noted that from time to time, we discuss the Fed. As a matter of fact, we do it quite a bit. Now, there's a reason for this, because when the Federal Reserve does something affecting the money supply of the country in one form or another, the markets react to it, either pro or con. And on Friday, the markets went down 300 points on a comment from a Fed governor that the economy is heating up and we need to raise interest rates. And that alone was enough to trigger a reaction in the market. Even if another Fed governor comes out tomorrow and says just the opposite, they will react on a knee-jerk basis. But if we look at it right now, you know, the leading economic indicators don't seem to indicate an overheating economy, but rather one that's really on life support right now. So what gives? What's the picture here, Jim?
Well, I mean, it changes almost monthly, depending on what's happening in the market. And, you know, with the market getting up to higher levels, market valuations are getting stretched. We've seen junk bond yields and the yields between corporates and treasuries compress. And so, you know, you see these comments that are made, and this was made by the Fed governor of the Bank of Boston. And his comment was, the U.S. economy is in danger of overheating. And therefore, you know, the Fed should move to raise interest rates, because the market was down about 25, you know, it wasn't doing much of anything. And then all of a sudden, boom, the stock market started to go down. And then all of a sudden, the headline flashed across, you know, Fed wants to raise interest rates, U.S. economy in danger of overheating. And I thought to myself, especially as we get into some of these economic numbers we're going to cover today, it's looking more like a recession. And I'm thinking, overheating where? It's certainly not in manufacturing. It's certainly not in retailing. It's certainly not in housing. Where is it? And it's certainly not in energy. So what the heck are these guys talking about? And but, you know, that's what markets do, John. We've spent all of last year focusing on what the Fed was or was not going to do, when they were going to raise or were they not going to raise. And we've done the same thing this year. Here we are, approaching September. Remember, going back to the beginning of the year, we were supposed to get quarter point rate hikes every single quarter. Well, doesn't look like September is likely to raise rates. In fact, if we look at the Fed funds futures market, right now, the futures market has a 24% probability of a rate hike coming in September, a 27% rate hike coming in November, and a 46% rate hike coming in December. So think about, you know, right now the probabilities are nearing close to 50%. And if you want to see whether they're going to go or not, usually when the futures market is over 50, 60%, that's a high probability, which it was going into December last year. But John, they raised interest rates a quarter of a point in December, and we just saw all hell break loose in all the markets globally. I don't care any kind of asset market, whether it was commodities, stocks, or bonds. Junk bond spreads got up to almost 10%. And that was just a quarter point rate hike. And so it's rather interesting that, you know, we're still paying a lot of attention on this. And the market is not looking at this realistically and saying, wait a minute, where's the evidence that this economy is overheating? So why the market sold off and did what it did? Well, and traders were looking for an excuse to sell. Well, they got one. What was interesting is the probability of a rate hike coming in December is 46%. I also looked at probability of rate hikes for 2017, John, and there's not one month of a Fed meeting where the probability is over 50%. They're all probably in the 40% range, and that's kind of like a linear forecast of the probability in December. So what that is telling me is market participants who are more accurate than the Fed's own forecast are saying, look, if they don't go in December, then, well, we'll move that over into January, February, March, etc., and we'll keep that percentage roughly about the same. So it's sort of, in many ways, the Fed's comments are confusing, and in a sharp contrast, as we're going to show with the recent economic data, and especially what we've seen in two key economic reports, the ISM manufacturing report and then the ISM non-manufacturing report, which really was one of the reasons you saw the markets rally this week, was what was happening with the economic number. That ISM number fell sharply, and we're going to get into that in this particular segment of the big picture, because, you know, here are the markets reacting to a Fed comment that the economy is overheating. There is just no place that you're seeing that. And that's why, in fact, if anything, if we look at the manufacturing sector, John, right now, the ISM manufacturing sector slipped right back into a contraction territory. It had been hovering in the low 50s. In the month of August, it dipped below 50. Any number below 50 indicates a contraction. And what is more important, the manufacturing sector has been flirting with recession since January, where for the first couple months of the year, it was in a contraction mode, 48 in January, 49 in February. And even though we came out of it in March, we've been around 51, 50, 51. Probably the best number we got was in June at 53. And here we are in August at 49.4. And so we got a brief pop in the manufacturing sector. And one of the things that we're starting to see is a closer correlation between the ISM manufacturing and the IS service sector, because a lot of what happens in manufacturing affects a lot of what happens in the service sector. But probably one of the biggest things that there was an alarm was a sharp drop in the ISM manufacturing number in terms of new orders. Inventories continue to contract. As we have talked about on this program, we've had five consecutive quarters of inventory drawdown. The employment sector in manufacturing is in contraction mode and has been in contraction mode pretty much throughout all of the year. We're seeing backlog starting to contract. Prices paid is falling. So this gets back to, you know, where are you seeing those inflation numbers? In customer inventories starting to drop. So everything that you were looking at is, and why this is important, because remember, take a look at what we do when we forecast. We make a forecast at the beginning of the year. And obviously, when the first half of the year doesn't work out the way you forecast, then what everybody says, okay, it's the second half of the year. It's going to be in the third quarter and the fourth quarter. Well, with these 2 week ISM reports, it's definitely indicating, John, that the second half is not going to be this robust recovery that everybody has been sort of forecasting, because we sure in the heck didn't get it in the first and second quarter. In fact, last year, the fourth quarter of last year for GDP was less than 1%. It was less than 1% in the first quarter, and it was only 1.2% in the second quarter. So the Fed still sticking to its target that we're going to hit 2% economic growth. These ISM reports indicate there's no way that's going to happen. So I don't know what these guys are looking at or what they're smoking over at the Fed.
You know, I'm wondering, Jerome, why would they say that? I mean, you have to look at economic data. Theoretically, they're looking at a lot of the same economic data that you're looking at. And the response about an overheating economy just doesn't seem to match the data. So why would they say it?
I really think when you boil it all down over the last couple of years, the Fed would like to get itself in a position to normalize monetary policy. In other words, they would like to reload the chambers and get interest rates up there. I also think they're worried about the market becoming overheated, because remember, since liquidity rushed into the market after Brexit, we have been hitting new records all across the board in the Dow, in the S&P, the NASDAQ. All the markets were going up, as Craig Johnson talked about in the first hour. There's wide participation in the market. And I think the Fed, and they've made some hints at this, they're worried about creating another asset bubble. I mean, what happens if we get to loony valuations? I mean, the reason stocks have been going up is simply investors are paying more for the same dollar of earnings. It's not because earnings are going up. Earnings have been going down. So I really think they're worried about a financial bubble that's going to develop somewhere in the market, whether it's junk bonds, emerging debt, or in the stock market itself. So I think that is more. Now, the Fed's not going to come out and say, hey, we really pay a lot of attention to the market. That's a big thing for us, because they're supposed to be independent of the market. So they'll often cite economic reasons for taking a position on whether they're going to heighten or tighten interest rates or they're going to remain on pause. So I think that's really what's going on here, because there is just a wide, wide disparity in terms of what the market is anticipating, what we've seen in economic news, and what the Fed is occasionally telling the market. It was interesting, after that comment, you had another Fed governor come out, especially when the market fell very quickly, down 300 points. You had another one that came out and said, well, you know, maybe we need to see more inflation data and things improve before we do it. So they're trying to, obviously, what's going on in the market is a concern to the Federal Reserve.
You know, what's interesting, too, is the comments made on Friday morning, which ultimately resulted in the market dropping 300 points, actually wiped out all the gains of the entire week that we saw. I'm not sure, is it down in negative territory?
Yeah, I mean, the Dow at this point, we're still doing it. There's about a half an hour yet for the market to remain open before it closes. But the Dow is down roughly about 1.7% for the week. You've got the S&P 500 down almost 1.9%. So all the markets are in negative territory all across the board, where earlier in the week, you had seen a rise in the market. And the reason, John, is for the very same thing we're talking about right now. You had the second ISM non-manufacturing index came out, and the economists were projecting that it would drop from, let's say, 55 down to 54. Instead of 54, it dropped down to 51. So it's barely a point above contracting again. And what was more alarming with that report, business activity fell from 59 down to 51. New orders fell from 60 down to 51. Backlogs fell from 56 to 46. And basically, inventories fell from 54 to 48. So it just wasn't the fact that there was a steep drop in the non-manufacturing service sector, but all the components within the index were a sharp, sharp decline. So I don't care if it's new orders, whether it's backlogs, whether it's what's happening with employment, everything that was going. So obviously, the market liked that, because what that did is it, after that report, the probability of the Fed going. Now, remember, we had a few glimpse of hope in the employment numbers, which we'll get later on here. And the probability was starting to rise for a September rate hike. You were hearing that in the marketplace this week that, well, you know, there's a good probability the Fed may want to go, actually. And you had some Fed governors hinting that they would possibly raise sooner than everybody was anticipating, implying that they might go in September. But that ISM report, non-manufacturing report that came out on Tuesday, caused the market to rally because it said there was a steep drop-off in economic activity, and the details of the report were actually even much worse. So on that basis, the market began to rally. And this is the kind of market we live in today, in that the markets are being driven by liquidity. So what is going on is bad news, meaning weak economic news, is good news for the markets, because that means, oh, the Fed will remain on hold, liquidity will be continue to be injected into the marketplace, and all that liquidity, folks, is good for asset prices. And so this was, you know, what we were looking at in terms of business activity this week. We saw weakening economic data. We saw the ISM report last week dipping into recession territory, contraction, and then we saw a sharp drop-off in the non-manufacturing sector this week. And so that was pretty much everybody was kind of taking a step back. Okay, with this kind of weak information, weak economic data, there's no way that these guys are going to be raising interest rates. And once again, it's been pushed off to the last month of the year. But when you have a drop in business activity, a drop in new orders, a drop in exports, a drop in inventories, supplier deliveries, and all those things adding up together, it's actually the opposite.
I guess the real question would be, what is telling us about our direction for the second half of the year? I mean, the first half of the year was a real snoozer. So here we are in the second half. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, what these reports are basically telling us, John, there's no way we're going to hit the Fed growth target of over 2% this year. This is going to be a 1% growth rate. And there's a possibility by the time we get to Q4, we could actually be below 1%. So forget 2% this year. This is looking more like a 1% year or less So this really is calling into question the Fed's thinking. But I think those comments were really made more as a cover-up that the Fed was worried about what was happening to asset prices than anything else. Because you can't look at these ISM reports that came out this week, last week, the leading economic indicators, what they're telling, what's happening on the employment front, as we're going to get into. It is looking more and more like we are heading into a recession in 2017. So I think they were more trying to dampen maybe some of the enthusiasm in the marketplace. So this really calls into question. And it's not just the ISM report. There was the Philly Fed report, which really covers economic activity in the 50 states. And you have almost a third of these states now starting to contract economically. So if you look at the Philly Fed, you look at the ISM report, if you look at employment trends weakening, all of this is telling us that, you know, this economy, we have a clear trend now in place. It is decelerating. And we're seeing this consistently now starting to show up in some of the leading economic indicators and some of the more advanced ones.
What would happen if we compared the PFS recession index? Because I know you compile your own listing of what I would call probabilities about where we're headed. How are they correlating with the general conversation out there?
Our recession index is now at 16.75. Usually when you get to 20 and above, which we did briefly in 2011, anybody listening to the program, I mean, it very much looked like the U.S. was heading into a recession. Remember all the things that were happening in that year. We had Fukushima, we had the Arab Spring, we had spikes in oil prices, we had the debt ceiling debate, the downgrading of U.S. debt, we had the pig crisis in Europe. All those things were coalescing together, and the LAIs were rolling over. And I mean, it really did look like we were heading into a recession. So that's the only time that, you know, we got close to 20 in our recession indicator. But what is happening now, it's been climbing steadily since probably the middle of last year. And that's why, you know, we have pointed out here that the economy peaked in the second quarter of 2015 and has been decelerating ever since that period of time, both in the third quarter of last year, fourth quarter, and then, of course, the first two quarters of this year. And here we are looking at the second half of the year. I mean, Q3 is not going to be a barn burner either. I think we're going to be in the 1% or less range. So it has steadily been climbing, John, from zero all the way up to 16.75. So we're only 3 points away from a recession. So if these trends continue, as we're seeing in the Philly Fed Index, in the ISM reports, and in employment trends, I think that there's good high probability that in 2017, unless something reverses, that we could be very well heading towards a recession.
You know, Jim, that's really amazing because I know for the last, 3 months here on the program, we have been forecasting this onrushing recession. What's interesting now is the contrast between what the indicators are showing and the political conversation going on between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And you're not hearing most of this, nor among any other candidates that I know of. I mean, occasionally Donald Trump will say something like the economy's not doing that well or something along those lines, but they can't let on that the situation is getting a little tenuous, shall we say, as far as staying afloat in terms of a recovery.
Well, no. I mean, in an election year, nobody, including the incumbent party, and we also know the media, does not want to do that because, I mean, but, John, number one issue in every single political poll that I've seen, there's two issues right at the top. Number one is the economy, and for good reason. And we'll talk about why these employment numbers really aren't a true reflection of what's going on the employment front. But the economy and security are the top two issues that come up in political polling. So it's no surprise that you're seeing the media kind of be mum on this. And that's why I think it has more to do with what's going on in politics than anything else.
Well, if we postulate that these trends are actually continuing, now we have a disconnect because it would seem like the markets are in record territory and they don't reflect this. What's the cause for the, what we call it, not the dichotomy here, but the dissonance?
Some of the strongest trends that are fueling this market has been corporate buybacks, which are lessening at this point. Second is central bank buying of securities. But also, you know, we live in a world of zero and negative interest rates. So there is a global search for yields right now. And the best yields are in the stock market. I mean, if you look at interest rates, I don't care where you're looking globally and even here in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. looks like a junk bond compared to bond yields elsewhere. We've got, I'm just looking at a global Bloomberg screen here. We've got negative interest rates in Italy on short-term sovereigns. We got negative interest rates in Spain, negative interest rates in Japan, negative interest rates in Switzerland. So what do you do if you're a pension plan or an institution, or heck, you're retired or an individual? What are you doing for income? So you've got this global search for yields. At the same time, you've got the Bank of England now engaged in quantitative easing. You've got the Bank of Japan engaged in quantitative easing. You've got the European Central Bank engaged in quantitative easing. And remember, when they buy bonds from the marketplace, whether it's corporate or sovereigns, the people they buy them from now have cash. So what do you do with that cash? You don't keep it in the bank because they're going to charge you money if you keep it in Europe or in Japan. So you invest it. And so that's why this market is being fueled more by liquidity reasons than anything else. And what it's doing is it's encouraging risk-taking by basically telling speculators that this low interest rate environment is going to persist for a long period of time, and monetary policy will be loose. And anytime there's any kind of case of market tremors, you're talking about a central bank put. So you're telling speculators, or the mindset of speculators, they're saying, you know, I can go ahead and take some risk right now, because if I do, well, the central banks will bail me out. They'll come in, they'll create more liquidity, they'll drive interest rates down or negative, and I don't have to worry about that. So I think if you want to tie things together in terms of the comment made by the Fed today, is they're seeing this speculative activity begin to heighten as markets head into new record territory. And they may very well, I mean, Craig Johnson may be right. If the Fed doesn't go in September, which I think they won't, and they don't go in November, we may get a very strong rally. And especially if the economic numbers continue to weaken, then you could see a strong year-end rally if the Fed doesn't go in race in December, as markets are expecting right now, at least almost a 50% probability. If they do anything at all this year, it'll just be once, a quarter of a point, and it'll be in December. So I really think that's why you're seeing this disconnect between what we're actually seeing in corporate profits and what we're seeing in economic activity and new higher stock market levels. It's just money chasing, you know, what's the definition of inflation? Is too much money chasing too few goods. Well, throw that definition into the marketplace, as Craig Johnson talked about. There's probably a 25% less outstanding stock today than where the market was back in the year 2000, either through M&A activity, corporate stock buybacks. So where's that money going to go? And that's what's fueling this.
Let's talk about your theory that money is chasing yields here, and could we justify that by what we're seeing in the markets?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you take a look at some of the top performing sectors in the market this year, they're all related to dividend yield. The utility index is up over 15%. Consumer staples up almost double digits. Telecoms up nearly double digits. And junk bonds are up 12% year to date. I mean, typically, if we go back to the beginning of the year, the spread, meaning the difference between a U.S. Treasury and junk bonds in January and February, John, that spread was 9 percentage points, meaning you could get 9% more in a junk bond than you could in a Treasury. And if we take a look at how, let's say, the last decade or so, the average of that spread has been roughly about 6.5%. As of this Friday, that spread is barely 5%. And if you take a look at the markets itself, defaults are low, but they're starting to rise. Other factors that you see of, let's say, speculation in Europe, we've all heard about negative interest rates on the sovereign debt market. John, that is carried over into the corporate bond market. You actually have corporations now, large corporations like Royal Dutch, actually issuing bonds at negative interest rates. In other words, you're loaning companies money and you are paying the company. So if you buy a $10,000 bond, you're actually going to get less when that bond matures, because people are looking for a safe place to park money and they're searching for yield. So we're seeing corporate spreads and junk bonds narrow. And the more that they narrow, the greater the risk that that implies. You're seeing corporations, once again, issue rates at negative interest rates along with sovereigns. And so all of this, John, is showing that if there is a problem, it's really in the markets, which are overheating versus, let's say, the economy overheating. But the Fed can't say that. They can't come out and say, well, you know, all this loose money and low interest rates is creating a bubble in the markets. They can't say that. So they refer to it in economic terms. And I think that's really what was implied by the Fed governor from Boston today.
Well, you know, Jim, though, we have unemployment numbers below 5% right now. I mean, President Obama has been saying for several months now, we've had record jobs being created. So theoretically, that picture looks rosy.
You know, and here's a problem with any kind of government statistic, and especially with the employment numbers, there's a lot of seasonal adjustments that we get in a lot of these economic reports. That's why I like things like the Fed survey. I like things like the ISM report, because they don't do all these seasonalities that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses. And when it comes to employment, they use something called the birth-death model, which says that, look, there's all these hypothetical new companies that are being formed and they create these jobs. Well, this is the worst job company creation recovery since World War II. There have been fewer new formations of new business in these last 8 years than any other time since World War II. So, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics really needs to go back and relook at their models, because they really don't reflect what's really going on in the economy. In fact, I forget what number it was probably July, where we had a big pop in the employment numbers, hypothetical. The actual numbers for that month, the economy lost 1.2 million jobs, even though the official report was we created 250,000 jobs. And if you dive into the weeds in the employment report that came out for August, earnings barely budged. The actual hours work were cut. And, you know, the job creation, they were phantom jobs created from hypothetical businesses on the birth-death model. And also, the rise in government payrolls, which were a large part of the employment numbers for the month of August, these were seasonal adjustments. Without those seasonal adjustments, government jobs actually fell by almost 900,000, just like in the month of July, where we reported 250,000 hypothetical jobs. The actual number was the economy lost 1.2 million jobs. And I think that's why, John, you're seeing a lot of the angst that you see in the market today with voters about the economy, and why the economy's issue number one, because this has been the worst economic recovery since World War II. And a lot of these economic numbers just don't add up. If you look at, for example, in the month of August, the birth-death model created a hypothetical 106,000 jobs. Those were hypothetical jobs. They weren't real jobs. And if you look at the U6 figure, which is really a more encompassing employment number, it's 9.7%. My friend Gary Schilling thinks it's probably closer to 11%. So you take a look at some of these stats that come out here, and you're starting to see a lot more companies, according to Challenger and Gray and Christmas. Computer firms, for example, have announced more than 55,000 job cuts this year. Cisco last month announced 5,500 layoffs. Another Dow industrial component, Walmart, said it's going to trim back 7,000 back office jobs. So you're starting to see Wells Fargo cutting 5,500 jobs. So you're starting to see now, remember, we've been following this employment trend and we've been talking to you about it. At the margin, you always look at what's happening in the margin. It wouldn't be too much longer, especially with corporate profits falling five quarters in a row, that companies would begin to start responding. Where did they start to cut back? They start to cut back on employment. We're starting to see that. So there are a lot of trends here that are more indicative and once again supporting what we're seeing in this deceleration in terms of job and economic growth. John, the numbers aren't what they are pretending to be. And that's one reason why I think you see the economy as issue number one in this presidential election.
Well, if we assume now we have been in this deceleration for some time, if we took a snapshot of now and we looked at last year at this time, what would we see over, say, a 12-month trend and a comparison between the two sections?
When you really look at the last 12 months and probably the last 18 months, because the economy peaked, in our opinion, just and also as reported by the government, the economy peaked in the second quarter of last year. I mean, if we look at the private sector GDP, the 12-month rate of change stands at 1.3% year over year, a level which since 1968 has always coincided with a recession. If we take a look at industrial production, the 6-month moving average and the 12-month rate of change have been negative for a considerable time now, which since the 1930s has never occurred outside of a recession. If we look at, for example, non-financial profits since the 1950s, they have not been as low as they are without a recession. If you look at capital spending, the 2-year rate of change is negative. And this is one thing that has puzzled economists, is why corporations just haven't invested. Well, folks, you don't build new plant, new equipment, new factories if you don't have orders to justify making those capital expenditures. And one of the things that we've been able to do and companies have been able to do is they've been able to produce more goods and services with fewer workers as more and more manufacturing gets automated. If you look at other sectors, new home building permits, the 12-month rate of change is now gone negative, which is it often does right before a recession. If you take a look at exports, especially with the strong dollar this year, the 6-month moving average and the 12-month rate of change are all negative, which also coincided with the recession. If you look at industrial sales, the year-over-year change is a negative territory, which has also been associated with the recession. And here's something that's even more telling. Tax receipts so far this year for the U.S. government are negative, meaning that they're starting to decline. And what does that indicate? It means fewer people working, people making less money, corporations making less money, translates into less tax revenues. If we look at the employment trends, they are decelerating. If you look at consumer spending, that is decelerating. And if you take a look at the monetary base, it is now negative. And then also this massive narrowing which we're seeing in credit spreads between corporations and, let's say, sovereign debt. So all of these things, John, it's kind of like being a detective. You always start looking at things in the periphery. You're looking at what's going on, and then you look for supporting trends and clues. And the more you widen that net, and that net is getting wider, the more and more you're starting to see conclusive evidence that the trends point to, at some point, a recession in 2017.
And on that note, we're going to pick up on that topic as we go into the next section of the big picture, approaching the peak, because obviously all of this has investment implications as the big picture continues on the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Today on Financial Sense, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to talk about priests, spells, and magical thinking. Before we do that, I want to introduce our next guest, Ben Hunt. He is the Chief Risk Officer at Salient Partners and also the author of the very widely read Epsilon Theory newsletter, where he regularly discusses the intersection of mass psychology, game theory, and the relationship to the dominant themes and forces driving the financial markets today. Ben, your most recent piece was titled Magical Thinking, and in it you discuss how modern technocratic central planning is very much related to age-old practices that go back thousands of years to primitive societies and cultures. So with that said, Ben, would you mind setting the stage by telling us a little bit about what cultural anthropologists refer to as magical thinking?
Sure, happy to, Chris, and thanks for having me on the show. You know, I started Epsilon Theory, and the whole name of it, Epsilon, comes from one of the, what I'll refer to as magic spells, one of the hallmarks of modern economic theory, and that's looking at investment returns as a combination of alpha, the edge that you have in understanding investments, the idiosyncratic returns of an investment, plus beta, just the market returns of an investment, plus epsilon, which in economic speak is usually epsilon for error, E for error. And the truth, of course, is that epsilon, there's real information there, but it's the sort of information that academic economists don't look at. Epsilon is where behavioral information comes in. Epsilon is where game theory comes in, the strategic interaction of investors and the like. And so, you know, from the outset, I've really been focused on, I'll call it the behavioral aspects of investing in markets. And so it struck me, because I like to make connections from different fields of behavioral science, is that both developmental psychology and cultural anthropology might have something to say about how we live with markets today. And I bring these two areas, developmental psychology and cultural anthropology, together because both of them have this phrase, it's a term of art called magical thinking. And in developmental psychology, this goes back to this guy, Jean Piaget, he was really the founder of clinical psychology when thinking about the development, the emotional and intellectual development of children. And his use of the phrase magical thinking goes back and says there's a period of time in really every child's life, typically between the ages of 2 and 7, when you haven't quite figured out how the world works. And what he meant by that was that our notion of causality, of X causes Y, is not fully formed when we're in that age between 2 and 7. And so the example that Piaget gives is that if you tell your 4-year-old child that, I'm sorry, Joey, but the family dog passed away last night, you know, the 4-year-old child, little Joey, will typically have 2 reactions. The first reaction is that he will blame himself, that either something he did or did not do caused the dog to die. And the second reaction he'll have is, again, this goes under the name of magical thinking, is that little Joey will come up with a notion that if only he can say the right things and think the right thoughts and do the right actions, then he can actually make the dog come back to life. That's magical thinking. And look, if any parent of a child, you know, you've seen this in your children when they're that age. It's a profoundly egocentric view of the world. And in truth, this was one of Piaget's points, every 4-year-old child is an egomaniac, you know, in the clinical non-judgmental sense of the word. So that's where that phrase magical thinking first appeared. But it's also used as a term of art when anthropologists talk about the development of human society. So it's not just the development of human beings, but also the development of human society.
Welcome back to The Big Picture here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. In Big Picture 1, first part of the program today, we discuss the likelihood of a recession in 2017, as indicated by most of the indicators you would watch. Now, we have economic trends decelerating right now. So then, what does this mean from an investment standpoint, just in both in terms of the independent or individual investor and the markets themselves?
Well, there's a couple things that come to mind, John. Number one, if these trends continue in the same way they are right now and begin to worsen, then at some point, the market's going to wake up to this fact and say, wait a minute, we don't care if the Fed's going to raise interest rates. We're now starting to focus on what's actually happening in the economy. Because up until this time, for the last couple of years, probably going back to 2013 when we announced the taper, the markets have been exclusively focused on central bank policy, what the Fed was going to do when it unwound its tapering and its quantitative easing, when they were going to raise interest rates, when the ECB started its quantitative easing, now the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan. All the market has been focused on is not an economic recession and a possible financial crisis. We've been focusing on what the heck are central banks going to do? So that's what we've been talking about here for the last 3 years. At some point, we're going to hit an inflection point. And I don't know what it is. It could be in the fourth quarter of this year where we get a really bad, let's say we get a bad print for third quarter, we go below 1%, or in December, you know, we see it reflected in Christmas sales or online sales. Something happens and all of a sudden the markets now begin to focus on, wait a minute, forget the Fed. The market will transition and begin to focus on what's going on in the economy. It's kind of like an approaching storm. When you start to see the barometer continue to drop, at some point you have to say, oh my goodness, a storm is coming. And so I think we're very close in the next couple months is that we're going to see some kind of pivot point where the market begins to shift what it focuses on. Remember, the market's very fickle. And for the last couple of years, it's really been the risk on, the risk off trade. In January, we were focused on China. We'll get to China as a possible risk scenario here coming up here shortly. But I think the high tide in economic prospects are directly ahead of us. And at some point, the market's going to wake up to that effect. And then what you're going to see is a flip of the switch. You're going to see us go from the risk on trade to the risk off trade and be in defense. And it was amazing because Jeffrey Gundlach did a piece on Friday, was making the news headlines, time to get defensive. And his piece was called Turning Point. And we've been sort of talking in this same kind of vein. In fact, Gundlach has been talking about this for a while, just like ourselves, that, you know, he's looking at the same economic numbers we're looking at. There isn't a secret out there that only a few people know this. I mean, this is out there for everybody to read. So at some point, John, that is going to happen and the market's going to flip. And what the real question is starting to rise now, just as this economic recovery has been called the new normal, it's definitely been unconventional and unlike any other kind of economic environment that we've seen since World War II. So that raises the question, if we go into a recession and we have another financial crisis, what is that going to look like? In other words, is there a high likelihood of a hard landing somewhere in the global economy and the possibility of another financial crisis, especially if we take a look at some areas of the world that are very vulnerable, Japan, China, and Europe. And so this has broad implications for what investors are to do, because right now there's a lot of enthusiasm, as Craig Johnson was talking about in hour one. We're seeing widespread participation in the market across all the major indexes. And usually when you're looking at the market, like last year, we had a very weak market. It was basically flat for the year. And we had things like the FANG stocks. These were the stocks like Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. These were few companies that were delivering growth as economic growth was decelerating. But if you look at this year's market, I mean, you take a look at where we are year to date, where we've seen some of the best returns outside the defensive area. We've seen it in the S&P Small Cap 600. We've seen it in the S&P Mid Cap, which is up close to 10%, even on this Friday. The S&P 600 stocks, that's up over 11%, even despite this correction. The Philadelphia Semiconductor Index is up over 16%. And of course, contrary to everything else that's going up in the market, the best performing sector still year to date has been the gold and silver index, with a lot of gold stocks up. Most of the major gold indexes up over 100% for the year. So you're talking about a market that could change from this risk on market and quickly reverse and go into the risk off mode. But I think people are starting to scratch their heads and say, wait a minute, this has probably been one of the most unusual recoveries. If we get into another financial crisis, what is it going to look like? Or what are the implications, broader implications, of a recession, especially right now where the driving engine of the global economy, believe it or not, folks, is once again the U.S. economy, which is almost 25% of GDP. In the last decade, it was all about China and China's growth rate in the emerging markets. Nobody's talking about emerging market growth in China having a major impact on the economy and economic growth rates.
Yeah, but even though things, I would say, look fairly stable right now, if there's one lesson that we can garner out of the last decade, at least the last 7 to 8 years, we live in a really unstable world, and the rules are all changing here. And if you are correct that this trend continues on the economic front, at some point in the future, there's got to be an inflection point, and that's the moment the markets are going to wake up to the fact that we're headed for a storm, and then they take a reaction to that.
It's amazing because here we are, the market's finally closed and the Dow was down instead of 300 points. It actually accelerated towards the last half hour of trading and we were down 400 points for the day. I think what is going to be interesting when you take a look at going forward, if indeed we do head into another recession, if indeed we have another financial crisis somewhere in the world, I think the next crisis will not be U.S. born. It will be overseas. And the three trouble spots that come to mind are both Europe, Japan, and China. But what's going to make this next downturn interesting is when we began the last downturn, we had the Fed funds rate over 5%. Now we're talking about a Fed funds rate that's only at 0.5%. It would really be interesting if the Fed does not go in December and you start to hear the Fed now start talking about lowering rates again or re-implementing, let's say, another form of quantitative easing. What does that say about monetary policy that the most the Fed was able to do was raise interest rates a quarter of a point? I mean, take a look at the Bank of England. They were going along the same way like the Federal Reserve. They had their interest rates at 50 basis points, and then they lowered them a quarter of a basis point. So, you know, what does the Fed do when you don't have your bullet chamber full of bullets anymore? I mean, so about the only thing they could do is quantitative easing. I think they'd be reluctant to do something like negative interest rates because they have to be looking over at what's going on in Europe and what's going on in Japan, seeing that it hasn't worked out very well.
You know, it's interesting that if we look at the last crisis, we go back to, it really sort of started in 2007, rolled in 2008. That originated, if you remember, how can anybody forget it, right? In the U.S. mortgage securities and the real estate bubble. But now it seems the next crisis is going to start overseas. And whether it's in the oil markets or wherever that happens to be, it's going to be interesting because the U.S. is still a major player in this whole thing.
Well, sure. I mean, the U.S. economy is, what, 22% of world GDP. And really, it's been as anemic as our growth rates have been at 2%. You got to remember, Europe has had two recessions since the economic financial crisis. Japan has had recessions. And so, you know, growing at 2% when you're the world's largest economy has had an impact because that means, you know, the U.S. is importing a lot of goods from other countries. So the global economy is driven more now by the U.S. economy than emerging markets. And what we're starting to see is global trade is contracting. So the U.S. slowdown obviously is going to affect the global economy more so than it has in the past because China and emerging markets are no longer the big drivers of global economic growth as they once were, let's say, in the last decade, where you saw China's economy really growing at double digits every year, along with other emerging markets from India to Brazil and elsewhere. So it's obviously going to be different this time around, not only just because of the impact the U.S. will have, and we're probably, once again, you know, we're the best looking house in a global neighborhood. We used to say that a lot. It's time to mention that once again. If you take a look at where the possible crises could emerge from when you look around the globe, they're more likely outside the U.S. in terms of the next financial crisis in its origin. It's more than likely going to be overseas.
You know, I would imagine that one item perhaps that right now is causing some investors to be skittish is if we go back in the past, you know, we'd have recessions, okay? And what would happen is the Fed would lower interest rates and that would cause things to heat up a bit and then we'd have a soft landing. And so everything was fine after that. 2007, 2008, that was a hard landing. And as you've been discussing on this program all this year, the Fed may be out of some wiggle room. You know, Janet Yellen's been trying to buy herself a quarter of a point there so that if we hit another recession, they could try some stimulus, but that doesn't seem to be working. So what are the chances of another hard landing? And maybe that's why people are justified in being skittish.
You're right. In past cycles up until 2007 and 2009, with the Great Recession, as it's called, we had a soft landing. Even after 2000, with the bursting of the tech bubble, Greenspan dropped interest rates down to 1%, and the housing market just took off with this big investment boom in housing and real estate. The stock market recovered after 2002. So in past cycles, they've been a soft landing, with the exception of what happened in 2007 and 2009. However, if you take a look at the recent downturns are becoming more severe, and there's a reason for that, and it began at the beginning of the last decade, is the accumulation of a massive amount of debt, which was accumulated. I mean, the U.S. economy went from $28 trillion in debt to $54 trillion in debt in one decade. Well, if you look at what's happened since this economic recovery, there's accumulation of massive amounts of debt. China's debt is up almost three or fourfold. And unlike previous recoveries, central banks have expended most of their ammunition. So even, John, if let's say that we weren't at 0.5% on the Fed funds rate, let's say we were at 5% and the Fed was able to start cutting rates if we went into a recession, the massive amount of debt, we're now seeing it at the corporate level in the U.S., consumers a little bit less so, looking a little better for consumers. A lot of that has to do with what's happened to housing. But even if they were to lower interest rates, there's just not that much room for expansion. Economic growth has been anemic. Corporate top line growth has been anemic. And so, you know, it doesn't matter what interest rates are. You have to be able to qualify for a loan. You have to have the ability to borrow. So I think all of these things are going to make the more likelihood that you're going to see a hard landing someplace else in the world.
Yeah, and maybe here's a worse thought in the course of the whole thing. If we do posit that maybe, again, we're going to have another hard landing because the Fed's out of room, just like we did the last time. But what if this time it's even worse?
There is that possibility. I mean, global debt has doubled since 2008, and we also have zero and negative interest rates. So you imagine if you're in the bond market and you're holding a bond that has a negative interest rate, and all of a sudden rates start to rise as they popped on this Friday with a little stress coming into the marketplace. You know, the reason people are buying negative interest rates bonds is they think that the interest rates will even get more negative, which means you would have a capital gain on that particular bond. So if you take a look at global interest rates at zero and negative, the lowest rates in history, global trade flows are starting to contract. And I would add another dimension that we haven't had since 8 years ago is geopolitical risk have heightened, especially with the failure of the Obama foreign policy. I mean, we're seeing so many hotspots flare up. The South China Seas, China's building military and naval bases in the region, conflicts with its neighbors, whether it's Vietnam, the Philippines, or Japan. You're seeing South Korea or North Korea get more aggressive with missiles. You're seeing ISIS expand globally. You're seeing conflicts in the Middle East, whether it's Syria or it's in Libya right now. You're seeing terrorist attacks spread throughout the Western world, whether it's in Europe, England, or here in the United States. So now we have geopolitical risks that are heightened.
And you see a lot of things going on right now. We have tensions going on the South China Sea. You've got things in the Middle East changing almost on a day-to-day basis with a rather crazy quilt of alliances shifting and changing. And then Russia's an issue, European Union. Where do you see the most probable hot spots for problems originating?
You know, outside a geopolitical conflict, a war someplace breaking out or something like the Arab Spring breaking out, you know, what if something was to happen to Saudi Arabia or let's say some of the more friendly Gulf state countries? Outside of that, there's three areas I see as high risk. One would be China. China has a hard landing. There's, you know, we've been debating over the last couple of years, would they have a soft landing? Could they pull it off? There's also the possibility of Japan on the brink I mean, they've been in this situation for two decades. And also Europe starts to come apart. In other words, there's more Brexits. Italy's a good possibility. Ireland is a good possibility if they're pressed on the taxation issue. And so, I mean, if we begin with China, first of all, you know, they're reporting that their economic growth is less than 7%. You talk to anybody that's knowledgeable, they probably think the true economic growth rate in China is somewhere between 2 and 3%, not the 7% figure that's reported publicly. Their debt is up fourfold since 2008. So China's debt to GDP ratio is growing faster than its economy. They also have an issue that they're going to be dealing with, which is aging demographics. And for China, that's particularly acute in the sense that, you know, they've had this one child policy in place since going back to Mao Zedong. So you've got an aging demographic, and also all of this government intervention in the economy, they've built up all this excess manufacturing capacity. You've got see-through cities with all these buildings with nobody in them. They're vacant. So you've got a lot of malinvestments in China, and you've got overburdened banking systems. And more importantly, China's economic model was built heavily dependent on trade, and especially with countries as large as the U.S. or the European continent. So now you have trade in contraction. And so there's a real risk there that you have civil unrest. I mean, that peace that Chinese leadership has with its people is dependent on a healthy economy and job growth. What happens when that goes away?
If we look at Japan and Europe, what are you seeing?
I mean, if you take a look at Europe, we've got Brexit, and I think Brexit was just the beginning. You've got this strain right now over tax issues with the EU in Ireland, in Apple. You've got this immigration that is straining the European systems. You've got the peripheral countries that are unsustainable debt. You know, how do you reconcile that in a union? You know, it'd be like heavily mortgaged states here. If we had several states that were in bankrupt that were depending on other states to support them, you've got this bureaucratic sclerosis that you see in Europe. And more importantly, the European banking system is much more fragile and less well capitalized than the U.S. system. So, you know, what are the implications of that? And so that's why I think that the next crisis, if it emerges and it's a hard landing, it's going to be outside the U.S. Once again, why the U.S. has the best looking house in a global neighborhood, that's been true throughout this economic recovery, and it's certainly going to be true going forward. If even if we go into a recession or we go into a financial crisis, it's going to be more severe overseas.
Now we come to that point where we always seem to every week, and what are the implications of all of this, Jim, on the investment markets and individual investors?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. If we get into a recession and a global financial crisis, and especially if it merges overseas, you're going to see a strong dollar bull market resume. That would have implications for corporate earnings. Obviously, if we go into a recession, we would be in the bear market in stocks. You would probably see more likely, if the economy weakens and goes into recession, a drop in oil prices again. So we could very well get back into the low 30s or 20s again. And then also, I think this time, just like we saw happen in Brexit, where you saw a severe precipitous drop in interest rates going negative all across Europe, you could see treasury yields as much as they are today. I think, what are we, about 1.6, a little over 1.6, almost 1.7 on the 10-year treasury. You could see treasury yields drop below 1%. Some are implying we can get down to 0.5%. Or even zero. And if you think that's crazy, folks, just take a look at British gilts now. They're down to about 0.5%. So it can happen.
Okay, here comes the peak. What do you do? Do you go to cash, or are there some other methods of positioning yourself for this change?
Well, I mean, we like bonds. We like treasuries. We also like short-term corporate bonds. We've been investing in that area since the fourth quarter of last year. We still like consumer staples and utilities. If you have to buy it, use it, or flip a switch, or smoke it, or drink it, you know, these are things that do well in economic downturns. And then I'd probably add a component of gold and cash. So you want to be diversified. I mean, you don't want to stick your assets all in one category, and especially if you're all in cash. Remember, folks, money market funds now can break the buck. So if you're in a money market fund and we get into severe financial stress, you could actually lose money on your cash. And you may even see in the next downturn where banks charge you interest rates to keep your money on deposit is one way that the Fed or the government tries to re-stimulate the economy. They don't want you sitting in cash if we're going into an economic downturn. You want to keep a portion of cash for buying opportunities. You want to have some gold, but you don't want to have everything in gold. Please do not do that. As many of our experts we've had on here, I don't care if it's a gold fund manager or experts on gold, I have yet to have anybody on this program from Barron's Roundtable members to even gloom and doomers that have said, put all your money in gold. Please don't do that. You would be making a mistake. And you want to have things that will produce income. We're very focused on income, whether it's short-term bonds, whether it's going to be treasuries, whether it's staples, utilities. We're looking for ways to create income because you need some kind of rate of return. So I would have a diversified mixed portfolio so that you can ride this out. It'll help you get it through. What happens, John, is investors tend to pick one asset class and go in it, as we saw happen in 2011 when it looked like the world was coming apart with, you know, the debt ceiling, the downgrading, the pig crisis, the Arab Spring, all those things were happening, and people were piling into gold as it got up to 1900. And boy, look what happened to them the next 3.5 years. Because if there is a downturn economically, or there is a financial crisis, you will see global QE at a level that will be truly historic in its response to a slowdown or a downturn in the markets. And you want to be able to capture that when it happens.
So what you're saying here is that you want a diversified portfolio, and believing that the crisis is overseas, the U.S. will be the best place to be. I think the real question, though, is if you've positioned yourself for that, what comes afterwards?
Well, I think what you're going to see, something that we've been talking about here as well over the last 3 months, is I think you're going to see helicopter drops. The G20 just met, and they were calling for massive fiscal stimulus. So I think that will be forthcoming from the developed world. You will see massive fiscal spending coupled with, let's say, central bank quantitative easing. I mean, both candidates for the presidency here in the U.S. are calling for that very same thing. And I would be looking for growth opportunities, those kind of companies that can buck the trend, that can grow their top line in a very slow growth world. And that's why you've seen, like last year was the FANG stocks like Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Investors will pay up for growth in a world that isn't growing. But John, I think, you know, the days of being a passive investor, sticking your money in an index fund, sitting back and just watching the market, I think that's over. You really got to be an active investor. And I would be betting on volatility. Right now, volatility has been low, but look for volatility to increase.
And of course, there's a factor in there called the human factor. And as you well know, I mean, you talk about the three stages of a bull market. Human emotion can be really strong. Sometimes the market will be in just euphoria. We've known that sometimes. There was the tech bubble back in the 1990s, real estate. But then when everything pops and blows apart, it switches very rapidly to pessimistic, and it can hang on to that pessimism for a long time, even when it's not warranted.
Well, I mean, we've seen that. Investors tend to be very emotional in their investing. And the downturn of 2007 and 2009 definitely had an impact on investors, the second bear market in 8 years. And we saw that happen. We saw that happen in 2011. We saw it happen again in 2014 and 2015. In 2014, they got overly optimistic. That was the year the market was up close to 30%. And so everybody was saying happy days are here again. And they got overly invested in index funds. And what did we have? We had 2015. So you got to be very, very careful, and you need to be proactive. Instead of trying to hit a home run, look for more consistent singles or occasional double instead of those home runs, and trying to knock it out of the park with one big switch. And that's what you see so often is like investors going all into bond funds after 2009, only to experience dropping dividends and yields over the next 7 years and the stock market going up over 200%. So it was the wrong thing to do. And that's what happens so often when you get this. And, you know, at some point in this crisis, if it does unfold or a recession, there's going to be fear. It's going to seem like the end of the world. I mean, go back to where it was in 2008 and 2009, and then look what happened since then. So that's why you have to be more proactive. You have to be more diversified and avoid the temptation of letting your emotions dictate how you invest, because they're just going to produce a disastrous result for you. And it's amazing, because a lot of the clients that have been coming to us, the new clients that is over the last couple of years, is basically they've just thrown their hands up and they just said, I can't figure this out. I can't let my emotions dictate it because it's really starting to hurt me. And that's what you don't want to do, is you don't want to let your emotions determine your investment decisions.
Well, Jim, if we had to wrap this off on a note that's, I guess, sort of comprehensible, if we take what we've discussed and we look between now and the end of the year, what are you going to be looking for and planning on?
Once again, the very topics that we've been talking about, we're looking for those confirming trends in the economy of deceleration. If we see those trends continue going forward, then I think the likelihood of that December rate hike will be lessened and lessened. As that happens, I think that would be bullish for the markets. We will also have the resolution of the presidential election in November, so that could be positive for the market. That removes a bit of uncertainty from the market. You also have, what we're going to also be looking at is we're getting right to the end of Q3 here. So we're watching corporate earnings announcements. If you have some dirty laundry, you're going to want to get it out now before the quarter ends, so analysts can drop their estimates of corporate earnings and then you can come out and beat them. So we're watching corporate earnings, we're watching the economic numbers, and of course we're going to be keeping a close eye on the polling, because 17 days from now we'll have the first presidential debate. So, you know, it's going to be the most widely watched debate. So, you know, by November that's going to be cleared up, and I think if the economic numbers continue as they are in the same trend as we've been seeing, then that takes the December rate hike off the menu, and that could very well give us the type of year-end rally that Craig Johnson was talking about in hour one. But we'll be here to watch it and talk about it, as I hope you will. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.